Alright, welcome everybody. This is a workshop on Tales from Free Radio in the 21st Century. So I think we're going to go chronologically, giving some historical context to the Microchip Power Movement. Maybe we're talking about rulings that the government has made as far as how they affect radio. And then later going into the 80s and 90s and talking about the micropower movement. And then we'll also talk about principles of free radio and unlicensed broadcast. And
what makes free radio free? Well, we're in place in which we're free. So we're here to talk about free radio, what it is to us, why we do it, and why we're continuing to do it in the wake of the creation of the LPFM service, which is a question that we always get. But first, I want to talk a little bit about what free radio is not. It's not a licensed broadcast, I think we all know that. It's not legal under the Telecom Act of 1996, the Communications Act of 1994, or the Radio Act of 1927. It's not a couple of Yahoos running their mouse and an iTunes playlist. An unlicensed station could be such, but that would not fall into the category of free radio as a self-aware, socially conscious movement, which is we identify with the movement. Free radio is not for profit, and it's not regulated in form or content, except the regulations that we place on ourselves, and there are some. So what is free radio? Free radio is an unlicensed station programmed by volunteers for the benefit of the community. It's a venue dedicated to freedom of speech and artistic expression. It's a tool for education, outreach, and activism. It's a facilitator of discussion around ideas and issues that impact the community. And it's a self-aware, socially conscious movement that has been active in championing free speech and media democracy and helped push the FCC to create the LPFM license service at the beginning of the century.
So, radio technology was coming into focus essentially in the 1920s. It was invented, it was funded by the U.S. government and part of the Air Force, Navy, helped pilot the whole project. But when radio came on the area in the 1920s, and hundreds of stations sprung up, and to help regulate those stations, a group, in 1927, the Radio Act created the Federal Radio Commission. And during that time, NBC and CBS were created out of broken a monopoly from AT&T. And let's see. My notes are so sorry. This is awesome. So the Federal Radio Commission worked with these companies once they were broken up essentially created it was a board of five people, first of all, that's important to know. Essentially, when it came into power, the FRC, that is, it basically made it so that all the nonprofit and educational stations that weren't for-profit stations became almost non-existent with the Radio Act. And so, of course, this opened up a lot of debate, and people were outraged, that they couldn't have their stations on the air. And the technology was still developing, but it was decided somehow that it logically made sense to let for-profit stations, just be in charge of this developing technology. Although, after 7 years of this debate, over who has access to the airwaves and why they should have access to those airwaves, the Federal Communications, the Communications Act of 1934 came out, and the FCC was formed, and it gave back some of the demands of the people, just because groups like ACLU were opposed to the FRC, and social movements wanted access to the airwaves, as well as labor movements and so on. But the FCC was really kind of the grandchild of the National Association of Broadcasters. And the National Association of Broadcasters, of course, was a lobbying group.
Yes.
Is a lobbying group. And it formed with the dollars of the big for-profit stations. And basically, much like Ted Stevens seems to think about the internet today, the National Association of Broadcasters said the airwaves are too complex for the average person to understand. This is, it's difficult to understand tubes to make up the internet. And they should be regulated by an entity, and they played a heavy part in creating PR for creating the FCC. Once it was created, as you know, the FCC is a body separate from the rest, from other lawmakers. Like, they're in charge of, they have a large say in what goes on in broadcasting, but it's pretty undemocratic process, as our system does not have to say really as to what they're doing entirely. What else?
Well, the questions that come out of that for me are, what gives the FCC the right to exist and regulate the airwaves? The way I see it is, well, the actual first broadcast ever was in 1906. Regular broadcast of any kind that commenced until 1912. World War I shut down broadcasting. This was all, there was no license for this at this time. And then broadcasting began to grow up until 1927, but it was largely in the hands of the inventors and the technicians. And as people developed the technology, it was still experimental, and it was all AM broadcasting. The technology was new. They were still trying to sort it out, work it out. AM broadcasting has a really wide signal pattern. And, of course, there was some interference starting to happen with dials. The rationale given for the original Act of 1927, the creation of the Free Radio Commission, which became the FCC, was to eliminate chaos on the dials so that people could actually be heard. But the industry was still experimental and was never given the opportunity to self-regulate and work out these problems for themselves. Instead, the government just stepped in there and laid down the law, how it's going to be regulated, and the FCC and its regulation has always, from the very beginning, been in the interest of big business, even though the 1927 Act chartered the FCC to operate in the public interest, convenience, and necessity. There's definitely questions about whether or not they've done that.
So now that big business pretty much runs the airwaves, there was a time in the 70s that Class D license was given, but then it was quickly taken back. And Class D license would be basically for the healthcare time today, but that was very short-lived. Enter the 80s, and 1986, a fellow by the name of Mbana Kintanko in Illinois, Lincoln, Illinois, started
Springfield,
Illinois, started what would then become the sort of the center of the spark of the micropower movement, which was a term that he coined himself. And he operated out of apartments in the projects in direct resistance and contrary to the FCC. And started mostly, it was originally called WTRA, because one of the big fights was for tenants' rights, so it stood for the Tenants' Rights Association. Over the years, it's been called a number of different names, including Black Liberation Radio, and now it calls itself Human Rights Radio. And as Monica Taco sees it, the FCC doesn't speak to the human rights of Springfield's African-American community. In his own words, he says, "We weren't around when they made those laws about licensing. We were sitting in the back of the bus somewhere. So why should we be responsible to obey the laws that oppress us?" which is still uphill today, is the fact that the micropower movement comes out of, in some relations as well as hip-hop, is as a form of art and a form of expression that's in defiance of systematic oppression. And up until this day, the laws that are made, the laws that are created that define who and who cannot be on the airwaves is still out of the common people's hands and is based on a historical document of oppression. Let's see. So, there's a long history. What I thought was interesting yesterday was about the youth radio programs, workshops, which I think is great in reminding us that youth have been a part of the movement for a very long time. And in fact, as far as Black Liberation Radio is concerned, in WTRA, youth made up a very large portion of who was involved in the station. But youth became one of the primary targets of police repression. Police knew about the station. They were really out about the fact that they were operating in apartment projects. And so police would harass any sort of young person that they thought was involved with the station, and thus limiting youth voices on the airwaves. Let's see. Monty Katongo himself doesn't identify with the pirate label. And there's a lot of other broadcasters that don't as well, and they identify with micropower or microradio, because pirates brings up the image of stealing something when who owns it in the first place is all in the question of, based on the assumption that there is ownership. Free Radio Olympia has kind of embraced the pirate identity in some ways. I see it as a mockery of the idea of ownership and the fact that who really is stealing it. And some of our opinions is yet to see. And another critical part, that precedent that was set by Black Liberation Radio and the WTRA, was that it was a community-based radio station, which I think wasn't highlighted as much in the Pirate Radio USA movie. It talked, as far as politics were concerned, it mostly talked about convergences and mass organizing, when really one of the mediums and primary mediums and purposes of unlicensed radio is to engage the community and give people that historically don't have a voice out there, that people can connect to each other and know where to organize. And this was really key to the WTRA, which was the only station in Springfield that during the first war in Iraq opposed the Gulf War. And so then later comes along Stephen Dunford in Berkeley, who started Free Radio Berkeley, and that's where the sort of Free Radio name began to gain its popularity. And Dunford was massively inspired by Katongo, and it was really his court case, the United States of America versus Stephen Dunford, that gave the publicity to the movement, and that's when, and the fact that the ruling was in his favor. The Pirate Radio USA mentions that the court case, the United States didn't want to bring up the Constitution when confronting Dunford, because really, Dunford's standing on really solid ground, and that the Constitution backs up unlicensed radio. Because the Constitution, as it's put, says freedom of press. The press, as is stated, the printing press was the only form of mass media at the time. And since then, a lot of new inventions have come around. And also was stated by the fellow in Oroville, is that that First Amendment isn't a fence around the people, it's a fence around the government. And so that's where it's flip-flopped. And so the United States government didn't want to bring that up at all. So then they instead tried to bring up the issue that they were impeding on other frequencies and harming other stations, which there was no evidence of. So the case was dropped. And so this, after that, unlicensed radios blew up across the country.
Let me add that a little bit.
me too.
Yeah. So basically, his defense was that he has a First Amendment right to broadcast without a license, and you know there is that is a really good defense. And so because his case was dismissed on a technicality, that defense still has not actually been tested in court of law. I took this quote off a website, so it's in such a hurry, I didn't write down who wrote it, but it says, broadcast licensees do not enjoy the same First Amendment rights as other forms of mass media. Critics charge that entry regulation, either through utilizing the concept of natural monopoly or severely limiting the number of potential licenses available, as in LPFM, effectively uses the coercive power of the government to restrict the number of parties who benefit from involvement in telecommunications. So the law, the 1927 and the 1934 laws that created the FCC, basically, when Congress passed those laws, Congress passed the law abridging freedom of speech and freedom of press.
Another really key part of the free radio movement that began was networking with other stations, and that being, and solidarity being really key. Jennifer started by visiting Haiti and starting up unlicensed radio stations there, as well as in Chiapas with Zapatistas, which is something that still continues to get today. And it's one reason why we at Free Radio Olympia were really interested in coming to this conference, is because that is something that, well, since the LPFM, the movement became kind of split in a way. And so this, we saw as also an opportunity to build those bridges and for unlicensed and licensed to work together. And so that movement of solidarity and networking could still continue.
There's been a lot of different legal debates and a lot of different decisions made by the FCC since then that have affected licensing and the unlicensed micro power movement. And now that LPFMs are somewhat given some unlicensed radio broadcasters went the LPFM route, and then some others also just stayed and decided they will never ever take a license. I guess that's where.
Yeah, I'd take it there, but I want to open it up for questions for a couple minutes before we move on.
What time of year was the Berkeley?
94?
95? 1992 when he first started broadcasting. He was right after the Gulf War, he was protesting. He was using the radio waves to protest the U.S. invasion of Iraq in 1991, basically broadcasting the hills of Berkeley to mobile. And I guess the FCC tracked him down in 1993, I think, the first time.
And then they had to stay in the studio for a while, though it moved every few months.
Yeah.
And then the case, I think, was brought in 1995. The injunction against him was granted in 96, 98, was it that late?
97.
That makes sense.
Now the technicality that finally, that decision were reversed is that he never had applied for a license to the FCC and been rejected, so you haven't done that either.
Right.
Are you hoping to make a test case out of yours? Or you're just hoping to just stay alive as long as you can until eventually the man's going to come.
Well,
it may be years.
We have redundant systems, and we will go back one year when the man comes.
And actually, Mubarak Kantanko thought about making himself an example. And in working with the National Lawyers Guild to put a case to the United States, but decided that as his own personal beliefs, he didn't want to deal with the courts as they are, especially historically racist and oppressive form of punishment and justice or injustice.
Well, does anybody in this room see a value as for, you know, one of these groups or perhaps several of them, you know, trying to apply, being rejected, knowing you're going to be rejected? I helped a group in Eugene, by the way, that we were trying to fit in and get a waiver on that, and that was supposed to be a test case, but never materialized into that. But and then be able to follow and do in Dunfer's footsteps and perhaps get a positive rule.
We actually did that in Brattleboro.
Okay.
They had a 10-watt station, couldn't get a license because they don't license 10-watt stations.
Okay.
We brought the FCC sent the usual license or authority to operate letter, the cease and desist letter.
Okay.
So what they did is they got authority from the community to operate, and we brought the case first.
Okay.
Before the FCC did. We went into federal court for an injunction against seizing the equipment, which we didn't get. But they also didn't get an injunction to kick the station off the air. We beat the injunction on that because he recognized the value of the community and asked for more briefing. And we did something that Fro won't do. The Brattleboro wanted a licensed station. So what we finally said to the FCC, after nothing happened for 6 months, is why don't you just grant a license to Vermont Earthworks at 100 watts? Because you're not going to grant 10-watt licenses. The court is furious with you for not granting a license to this group. Give this other group, which is all the same people, a license. And they did. Hmm. So there is now a license station at 100-watt, but that's a political decision to get a license.
Okay. He's got a question back if they want.
Let him relate to that first, and then I wanted to ask an earlier question about the sort of historical background. But go ahead and finish this thing about Brattleboro.
Just the trick with that, though, is that Vermont Earthworks have applied for the license.
Right.
Earlier.
Right.
So they have ending.
It gave them an out.
So there's still not quite a way around starting with an application.
We need another case.
Are there any identifying parties in the list that might be good for this station?
I've always wanted to, but I haven't found the right one. Yeah, we'd love to find one. Seems like it would have to be a big city with a large population of people of color who've been excluded that have applied and been turned down because of the restrictive rules, and then bring the case with them.
Yeah, so to clarify this, it may be confusing for some people. The whole idea of a test case is before broadcasting without a license to apply and be rejected, and then once you're rejected, go on the air anyway and see, you know, if they bust you, and then bring it before the courts, you know, using those arguments that we did not. And that's what happened with the Dunfer case. He had never applied, and so
Judge Wilkin, being intellectually lazy, found it out, basically.
And one more clarifying piece of information. The man has come to Olympia before, and the man, or the woman in this case, left. So that doesn't mean the enforcement climate is the same everywhere as it would be in Olympia.
And FCC, the field staff, with the cutbacks and the offices being closed, or at this point, they'll pass you mostly only if there's a complaint. But all you need is one. So, do you, for example, self-police yourself at all for, content or four-letter words or any garbage like that? All we need is one grandma somewhere who doesn't like the rap song you're playing, and that could be a problem.
I'll answer that, but we're going to hear this question first.
Okay.
To go back to the earlier historical background, in 1922, the Supreme Court, because various stations were encroaching on each other's airwaves, ruled that the broadcast airwaves were a national public resource, like a public park, and that therefore it was up to Congress to regulate them. But as a result of this, we get the Federal Communications Act of 27 and 34. But the issue, maybe Larry can answer this, is that these frequencies over the course of the past 50, 60 years have been licensed by the federal government for fees, which are a tiny, tiny, tiny fraction of what the various stations or networks are actually getting out of profit out of them. And what I wanted to ask was, is there some way that this can be brought back into court and say, they're a public resource like a public park, the court's already decided on this, and therefore there has to be a legal remedy to this lack of access.
And that's a case that has not been brought yet, and I think could be brought. And we could, there's all kinds of equal protection grounds we could bring it on, which is one of the reasons I'd like to see it be a community of color, because then we get 14th Amendment equal protection issues. It's hard to do it otherwise. It's hard to do it on economic grounds because those fees are very small for huge stations, but they're huge for anybody else. And the technical specs, at least to get a full power station, aren't expensive and very difficult. Lots of studies, lots of engineering. But it could be brought.
I personally have philosophical issues with spectral bandwidth, electromagnetic spectral bandwidth being treated as real estate and commoditized property, public or private. And I was going to talk about that a little further on. We can answer your question about how we self-regulate. We do a little bit, and any of us can answer that question.
Well, basically, we obviously have a free speech philosophy, but we also recognize there are a few things that, you know, are not within the pro values that we don't do. And from our content, we ask our DJs, well, ask the DJs, it was actually, you know, it was decided on by the collective to ban hate speech and also threats to people in the community otherwise. So, and hate speech is a term that's obviously is very open to debate as to what is hate speech, although we expect there to be.
And we did define it further as a sort of, what's the exact word, a sort of language for comments that are threatening or directed to a traditionally marginalized group in a way that like alienates or perpetuates oppression. And that could be like sexism, ability, racism, etc. And the way we can't, and we've had things come up before. And the way we handle it is not like, let me set this route, but let's talk about it and make sure that everyone that's listening and everyone that's involved in Pro feels safe. Because that's really it. If we're going to be promoting community and actually like trying to reflect our community and represent it, then we want those that are whose voices are normally shut down to feel welcome and like they can actually express themselves without being hurt on the radio.
Another way,
I'm kind of curious about what you mentioned with the what you feel was the split in the movement and what types of actions need to take place to remedy that split.
Well, I was just about to pick up in my preparedness with that split.
I just have one thing before. I just want to go back to Monica and Taco for a second, because I just, whenever I talk about him, there's this myth that it's sort of just him, but, and there's also a myth that it's a community radio station, which it kind of isn't. Mbana's station, I visited it twice, it's really a family radio station, which is something most people don't really think about, but most people have never heard of his wife, Dia Kintaku, and she does a lot of the day-to-day business of the station, and his children are really active in running the station, but it runs out of their house, and so, it's really interesting. It's not exactly coherent with the whole rest of, you know, what people think of as free radio, because not everybody comes over to his house. It comes guests, but, like, nobody else has, like, real shows very much. I like to talk about it as the Kintaku Family Station because it really is very much her project and her vision as much as his.
Okay, and to finish answering your question about how we self-regulate in order to try to avoid complaints being generated, because the FCC Enforcement Bureau is a complaint-driven agency, We also still, for pretty much the content regulation we talked about is the only content regulation that we have. But we also self-regulate in a technical sense, in that, well, I mean, we're not co-channel with any nearby stations anymore, but when we were, we employed the directional antenna pattern so that we would not be radiating a lot of energy in the direction of our co-channel neighbors to try to avoid harming them and having them complain.
Yeah, you were on KBCS's frequency for a while.
We were, so. And that was a decision made by people before I got involved. Some of us are really glad that we are off that frequency now.
What do you want now?
98.5. Another way is spectral purity, and that is a concept of, you know, your transmitter, your signal, your frequency can be really tight, or it can be spewing all this mess out on the band and other bands and causing interference. And I feel, as a technician, that as a responsible broadcaster, I mean, it's incumbent upon us to ensure that we are not generating unwanted spectral content that will interfere with other radio stations and radio services. So that is something that we absolutely insist on. Let me just pick up the presentation here and get to the wonderful LPFM licensing service. I'm sure there are people in the room who know a lot more about this than I do. But I believe that the LPFM rule, people were finally able to apply for LPFM licenses in 2001. Is that correct? 2000.
It started in 2000.
All right. And that was something that people have been working for a long time. And some of the people involved with the movement for LPFM were broadcasting without a license. And there's a microphone movement. Some of those people were hoping to be able to apply for a license and wanted to see the creation of an LPFM service. And there were also people involved in the microphone movement who, for various reasons, including anarchist or libertarian ideals, had no intention of ever seeking a license. So when the LPFM service was created, it was perceived by a lot of people to be inadequate. And so some people, when some activists said, this is great, we've got a service, let's run with it, let's get licenses, and then try to make it better, there were other people who felt burned by that. Like, you've been working together in this movement, and now you're going to, take this crumb that the government is tossing at us. I mean, I hate to be blunt, but that's the way some people have articulated it. And so they felt like it was a lack of solidarity. There was sort of a division there. And that was unfortunate, because we're all motivated by the same ideal, be it democracy and freedom of speech. So I want to talk a little bit about why the LPFM service has been perceived as inadequate in terms of creating access in the airwaves. I don't know how many of you know about how, the whole, bird adjacency protection thing and how that restricted how many LPFM stations can be put on the air. Basically, the original language of LPFM legislation would have allowed more stations to be on the air, and the National Association of Broadcasters and other entities were able to change the legislation that vastly cut the number of stations that could go on the air and restricted most of them to rural areas. So that was one way it was seen as inadequate. Another way was people have issues with so many of the available LPFM frequencies being licensed to churches, especially Christian churches, which are already pretty well represented on radio spectrum, all radio broadcast bands worldwide. I don't know how many of you use the shortwave, but just the fact that and this is the case with any license, when you accept a license from the FCC, you're accepting regulation, but it could be so censorship of your content. You're accepting having to abide by copyright laws and pay royalties, which restricts format and content. You have to pay costs that are prohibitive for a lot of people, especially lower income marginalized groups. I mean, it's not extremely expensive, but it's at least a few $1,000 to get a healthy compensation. You ever heard of it? What's the least amount of money you think
you should
SP. You can put a license to sell a compensation with you.
I don't know, some groups have gone on with like $6,000, $7,000, $8,000 and then they're operating, they do have some operating expenses for it. Although, it's important to note that Fed can be LPFM and not pay your royalties and not pay all that other stuff.
Okay. By not playing copyrighted music.
Yeah. Well, by just breaking the law. Okay. You know, it doesn't deal with royalties or any of that sort of thing. Okay. So you can be violating all kinds of other laws and still have our license.
Right. But you might not be able to
do it. Well, FCC doesn't care.
Yeah, you know, it wouldn't jeopardize your FCC license.
If you're a legal entity, you know, you expose yourself in a way that you don't when you're not.
Right.
You're basically only the front artists that are suing you.
Yeah.
Well, the artists aren't going to do it. It's the RIAA.
Yeah. Or the music publishing companies that say maybe. Anyway.
I just wanted to clarify. All you've been doing that's different is a certified translator in an EAS.
Right. I'm about to talk about the EAS system. If you said $6,000 to $8,000, why would only earn for about $600 at 100 watts?
Well, I was saying, the only difference in price would be the EAS.
Well, the certified translators are more costly than.
Yeah. So is the only difference of like $2,000 between a low power and a
fee? Which could be prohibitive for people. Okay, and then there's the fact that when you accept a license from the SEC, to a lot of people, you're accepting a license to be regulated from a questionable authority. What gives the SEC the authority to exist? We talked about that. I'm going to talk about what gives the SEC. The question of what gives the SEC the authority to continue to exist and to enforce. And then there's the fact that if a big corporate broadcaster wants your frequency, then you can lose your license. It's not secure, not as secure as a big full power corporate license. So, you know, those are ways in which LPFM is different from free radio. There's also this restrictive siting, and this has been a problem in Olympia of KOWA, is that the terms of their license required KOWA to site their transmitter at a location where there was no AC power available. And so they had to deal, they had to look at the, facing the additional cost of installing some sort of alternative power structure for their transmitter site.
I don't know if this has to do with this additional being here, but I think it's a very creative session to the larger radiation community.
Yeah.
I guess it's best described as a quasi-secondary, but she's basically correct that a commercial station, or even for that matter, even a non-commercial station, if you have to have an LPF non-com band, there's a potential that they can move closer to you or increase power. And in extreme cases, force you off the air. The less than extreme case is stop on your signal from band.
Now, on the other hand, that could happen to a free radio station as well. If, for instance, 98.5, it probably will be licensed to a translator sometime in the near future, and you will be faced with looking at having to move, change frequency, or having the SEC take us off the air. If the SEC comes to take us off the air, all they can seize is our equipment. There have been cases where they've prosecuted individuals, but that's usually, or has like always been, cases of repeat offenses, which, we haven't had any individuals who have been prosecuted before. So it's a lot easier to replace our equipment than it would be for a license station to replace their license. In fact, we have lost equipment software. So, you know, if we rate a lot of people transmitter wherever we can, you know, we have fewer restrictions, you know. So, you know, we're not restricted in a lot of these ways. And I wanted to talk a little bit more about the topic of copyright. First I'll talk about the EAS, because you brought that up. I'm going to talk a little bit more about the FCC and how they were chartered with making radio stations operate in the public interest, convenience, and necessity. How is public interest being served today by allowing big monopolies like Clear Channel and allowing those stations to operate on autopilot, not even having a DJ in a given radio station? How many of you know about what happened in Minot, North Dakota, in 2002? A train derailed. Yeah. This is a classic example. A lot of people talk about this, but a lot of you might not know. A train derailed, spilled toxic materials. There was a toxic gas flow, and it was like the middle of the night, and one source said that 6 out of 9 radio stations in the Minot area, I saw another source that said 6 out of 7, maybe that was in Minot proper. 6 of these radio stations were owned by Clear Channel and were operated on autopilot. No DJ, nobody in the studio in the middle of the night. So public officials were trying to get a hold of the station manager so that they could use the radio station to warn the public about the toxic gas cloud. And precious hours were lost before they were able to get a hold of him. Now, I'm not going to argue on whether or not Clear Channel is legally liable. Clear Channel's defense was that public officials should have used remotely automated the emergency alert system. But, you know, that does just point out the dangers of what happens to localism in radio when we don't even have anybody in there. It's just playing on autopilot. The DJ might be in New York City. I don't see that operating in the public interest. I think the FCC has failed us by allowing Clear Channel to operate as a monopoly without serving localities and communities. All right, now what's the EAS, the Emergency Alert System? It's a national system in the U.S. put into place in 1994, superseding the Emergency Broadcast System. Everybody remembers that.
This is nice.
And it's jointly administered by the Federal Communications, FEMA, the Federal Emergency Management Agency, and the National Weather Service. The official EAS is designed to enable the President of the United States, we all love him, right, to speak to the United States within 10 minutes in the event of a national emergency. This is the federal EAS. The official federal EAS has never been activated. The FCC requires all broadcast stations, all licensed broadcast stations, to install and maintain EAS decoders and encoders at their control points. These decoders continuously monitor the signals from other nearby broadcast stations for EAS messages. And upon reception of an alert, a station must relay the messages immediately. And they require monthly tests. So there's also voluntary EAS systems at the state and local levels.
Do not have. I am a DJ on the air. That comes through. I have the choice to turn my radio station off.
That's true.
Or to put it forward.
Okay, you can try that
message
off.
I'm in their man.
National message is the only one that has to be immediate. But,
So if it's a state or local EAS, you don't have to broadcast it, right? It's voluntary. But on a national level, which has never been activated, I believe you did.
Yeah.
You're requiring. Okay, so this includes
some freedom, at least.
Right. So this includes licensed telecom stations. The federal EAS has never been activated in a disaster. The federal government has been criticized for not activating the EAS in 9/11, which was an attack, supposedly, on our entire nation. The local Minot officials didn't activate the EAS. The state and local EASs are often activated in error. February 1st, 2005, Colorado received a statewide EAS activated accidentally. On August 5th, Florida and Georgia received a regional false alert from the National Weather Service that a radiological hazard warning was a code was sent instead of required weekly tests. The difference was one letter. Something similar had occurred in Las Vegas the day before. And right here in the Puget Sound, in May 2006, two false Lahar warnings were given. A Lahar is a mudslide off of Mount Rainier, specifically in this area, that could wipe out huge populations in Pierce County. The swallow everything that's path and bury the throughout valley floor and where 60,000 people live. So what happened in May was that first it was a Pierce County Lahar warning that went off and people were terrified. And I don't think every station carried it, but people were horrified. There were some people who like rushed to their schools to take their children out of school and leave the area. And then a few days later, a statewide Lahar warning was sent, and almost no station carried it because they were like, oh, this is suspicious. This just happened a few days ago. And it was false, but what if it had been a real warning? It's a classic case of boy crying wolf. So these examples I've given to show like that the EAS is not really that useful if people aren't using it properly and if it's constantly activated on a false alarm system. So if you accept a license you are buying into having to employ and use this EAS system or turn your station off, which is, not really that much of a great option. And besides, the federal EAS is managed jointly by FEMA, and you trust FEMA. FEMA completely failed New Orleans. I mean, I think it turned out that the guy who ran FEMA was like a horse trader or something. He had no experience in emergency management. So what has FEMA been doing? They built concentration camps, detention centers, nationwide in remote areas that are sitting empty, waiting for the first mass uprising, regardless of the fact that periodic revolution was regarded by Jefferson and other founding fathers as necessary to maintain a true democracy and preventing tyranny. Our failure as a nation to exercise this necessity has gotten us where we are today. Under the second rule of the scion of a family, which funded the Nazi war effort, talking about Prescott Bush, and the FEMA camp sitting empty and waiting to receive us all at the touch of a button to activate the mandatory federal EAS. And all license stations that air this call to suppress popular uprising, incarcerate citizens, will be complicit in tyranny and the final corruption of U.S. democracy by the forces of tyranny. Passion. And I have to say that because I feel strongly that one of the reasons why I will never accept a license is that I won't accept being complicit in that. If that system were to be used that way, I very well could. Yeah. So I guess we've been asked to finish up. I had a lot of stuff to talk about intellectual property rights. Copyright law.
Yeah, I guess we should open up with some quick questions and then let the next workshop go on.
Okay, I'd just like to say quickly, my passion is for radio explicitly as an organizing tool. That's absolutely a legitimate use of the medium for political organizing. But I'd like to point out within that we have various scenarios for political repression coming up in the future. One is the kind of stuff that FEMA has planned for, total martial law, formal suspension of the Constitution, all of that kind of stuff, in which case pirate broadcasters would be the only ones presumably doing any sort of organizing through the airwaves, but also just as presumably would be a target for the for jamming and signals intelligence tracking of the Department of Defense. But short of that, if we're seeing only increased political repression, it may be sometimes that the pilots are going to be the ones that are taken out and that the licensed stations will function in the interim. But I think really key issues about that continuing role as an organizing tool have to do with the conflicts with institutional licensees and commercial licensees that are going to hold back on that organizing function, which I think is the heart and soul of the movement, for me at least. That's all.
Yeah, that's a good point, but operating as we do, you know, we've developed a lot of experience in moving our transmitter and being able to build sites quickly and disappear and reappear in new locations. So we're kind of, you know, in a way developing skills for the potential of climate and increased depression so that we might be able to continue to operate on a guerrilla basis and help provide information and mobilizing for community resistance in the preventive martial law.
And one other thing I would add is the awesome example that we have, I think, of particularly in Europe and Latin America with radio as a direct organizing medium for popular resistance on a neighborhood, you know, in the street level, and that's an incredibly powerful example.
So one thing I didn't say is that I will never broadcast with all license because I'm an anarchist and an anti-authoritarian and I don't like passing authority to government. And the reason why I didn't use that as my defense is because I know that wouldn't resonate very well with the majority of people in this room. I mean, you might understand me, but you might not agree, you know what I'm saying? So that's why we felt it was important to present arguments to defend our case, to defend our right to continue to broadcast with a license, to explain why we do it, that might actually resonate with the rest of you. And I hope that we were successful doing that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.